All right, everyone, welcome to this edition of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, and breaking news, for the first time ever, a co-host of this show is a Republican. But
I appreciate that very much. It's good to be a Republican and a Libertarian at the same time, and it's great to be with you, and yet not where you are geographically and not where I usually am geographically. I'm in New Hampshire today, having just attended Pork Fest and having gone around the state to meet with a number of people. It's good to be. It's a gorgeous day in New Hampshire today.
And Mike, yeah, you're right. You are. I was going to say you're up in New Hampshire. Just got done with, I guess, with Pork Fest. Before we start on our topics today, how was Pork Fest for you? It must have been a weird situation heading back to Pork Fest after your announcement switching parties, and also slightly different from when you were running to be our VP in the Libertarian Party. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. In fairness, everything is always different from everything. This was my, I guess, third or fourth Pork Fest. It was a comfortable fit in the sense that most of the people there are Libertarian and most of the people there are Republicans. So in that sense, you know, I fit right in. In fact, I would go so far as to say in years past, there was a little bit of, you know, why are you in the Libertarian Party kind of vibe, because most of the people there are not registered with the Libertarian Party. Right. Great conversations. As a matter of fact, I did a podcast with Eric Brakey yesterday. As most of your viewers will recognize, Eric is the executive director of the Free State Project there, obviously a very important guy in New Hampshire politics, a former state senator from Maine, not from New Hampshire, who relocated to New Hampshire, as is the encouragement to do by the Free Staters, of course.
Right.
Did a podcast with him and did talk about just this, did talk about the switch to the Republican Party, did talk about Republican politics as well as American politics, including what it is that you and I have been talking about lately, that there is some discourse and discordance inside of the Republican Party in anticipation not only of President Trump leaving the party, but over today's topic, which is whether or not we are going to go to war with Iran. And this is something that divides Americans, divides Libertarians, divides Republicans, divides all kinds of people, right?
Right.
So it's not like any particular group is immune to having to go through these debates and discussions. And before you and I launch into it, I think it's important for all of us to bear in mind that not only are there a couple of different debates going on that we need to separate out, but we need to recognize that individuals of good faith can differ on these issues. You know, the first debate being how you feel about how Israel has prosecuted the war in Gaza, as well as offensive actions against the Iranian proxies in the region, and how you feel about Israel having attacked Iran. That's one debate. And then there's a separate debate, which is what the United States government should be doing about it. And I would just encourage everyone to bear in mind that these are two different debates. You
all
can
right.
feel one way or the other about Israel, about Iran, about the proxies in the area, about Gaza, about the Palestinian crisis, about the way Palestinians have been treated for a great length of time. You can feel one way or the other about all of that. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of Americans have felt one way at one time
right.
and a way at a different time.
All
no matter
right.
how you feel about that, that does not necessarily suggest, and therefore you need to feel a certain way about the other debate, which is what should be America's involvement.
Right, right. And before we launch into it, there's so many things. This has tentacles everywhere, right? So on last week's episode, we kind of joked, you know, that you wanted to be in position as part of the RLC, Republican Liberty Caucus, to say, we want to influence the coming schism, the coming battle for the soul of the Republican Party, right? Like that you said, hey, and by the way, for those that might be, well, and believe, but Mike and I talked about this. Mike is not immune to what he sees on X or hears, you know, in the other forums and stuff, right? There are people who are disappointed in Mike for leaving the Libertarian Party. I mean, that's not news, right? But if you agree with Mike's positioning, right, which is strategically, if you're interested in liberty and you're not interested in political labels, like since the big debates are going to be happening in the Republican Party, Mike wants to be part of the thing that says, let's bring the Republican Party more to liberty, more to the principles of liberty. So if you buy into that, we said, hey, Mike, you got 3.5 years to ramp up, right? Well, like, because when Trump's out of office, that's when the real battle for the GOP starts, right? But Mike,
and arguably sooner, which is what you're about to say.
Which was since the last episode in a week, this may accelerate to this weekend where you have a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, right? So we'll talk about the politics of it as we evolve into it. But let's just start off with the. Just the very obvious thing, which is over the weekend, we had this issue where President Trump decided to celebrate his birthday and the armed services birthday with a big, flashy, militaristic parade. Before the news of Iran came out, everyone was like, hey, what's Trump into? This is very reminiscent of like some communist country, the USSR in 65 with, you know, Brezhnev and, you know, whatever. Khrushchev and all these guys, and then on the heels of that, we have Israel bombing Iran, and the almost accepted fact that the U.S. blessed this, that Trump was okay with this, and then the following days, the Trumpian sort of like, we warned Iran, I've been warning Iran for 20 years, blah, 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 blah. Mike, a lot of different things worked in here. First of all, A, do you think the administration had advanced knowledge of this bombing? Do you think the military parade, even though it had been planned, don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that, somehow ties into this, let's get the people patriotic, saluting the tanks and the planes and the soldiers. Now we have this bombing. Does it make it more palatable to those in the Republican Party, to the nation at large, who said, why are we getting involved with another war that doesn't involve us? Why are we in the middle of this?
I hear you. I don't believe in the theory that there is so much planning that everything reflects and ties into everything else. I think you're right that the parade was pre-planned. I do think the parade feeds into what I think the administration wants to project as an image, which is one of patriotism, which is one of reverence for our military institutions. And, you know, at face value, that's all good.
All right.
You're right. The story itself is reminiscent of what some other countries have done, including those who want to intimidate their neighbors, right? And so you did. You brought up a couple of examples that were pretty cringy. And those regimes, I don't think anyone would argue, were doing anything but showing off the fact that they are willing to lean into their militaristic nature, both as a matter of foreign policy and culturally. And, yeah, bringing their domestic politics along with them, but sending a big signal the neighbors that they were trying to intimidate and adversaries around the world. No question about that. And so I think it's logical that people would look at the administration and say, you're not trying to do the same thing, are you? And I'm not convinced. I'd like to cut the administration a little bit of slack here in the sense that, you know, the president has said things in the past about trying to stay out of wars. And we're going to have to take him at face value to a certain extent, until he proves with certainty that was all something that was just water flowing under the next bridge or the next one, I think that we owe him a little bit of time during which we take him at face value that his at least plan A first brush reference would be to try to stay out of foreign wars. I do think that it fits culturally with what it is the administration was trying to do. I think that's what the parade was all about. That doesn't mean that it wasn't cringy for some Americans to look at. I think the timing is awkward. But in fairness to the administration and condemnation of our foreign policy over the past 60 years, it's always a cringy time for that parade because right. The United States is always doing something dumb to project military power. It's very difficult to pick a point in time when now is not a cringy time to have a militaristic parade. It'll ramp up patriotism without looking cringy like we're trying to lean into our militaristic nature and intimidate our neighbors. It always looks like you're trying to intimidate your neighbors because that has inherently been a part of our foreign policy for decades and generations. And that's not all the administration's fault. I think that you and I personally would have appreciated a little bit more cultural sensitivity with the parade. But I don't think it was necessarily because they were anticipating getting into something. Having said that, here we are, right? And I think that of all the reasons there are to be skeptical about how these decisions are made, let me throw one more out there. We're going to talk about all of them, but let me throw one more out there because you brought up the parade. The president does expect lots of folks to fall in line, however he comes down on a particular issue.
Right.
I think that's fair to say, right? He doesn't like a lot of discussion in public about whether or not the administration is making a mistake, right? In fairness, no administration likes that. You know, you need to have your discussions behind closed doors, which is one of the reasons why you and I have been a little bit critical of having these open cabinet meetings where everyone obviously feels like they have to say wonderful things about each other and about the president, about the administration, about the vice president, about everything that we've done the past few months. And it's just, it's not a great look. It's not a great look for a democracy. These things have to be handled behind closed doors. And so you saw the president was not happy with Tulsi Gabbard, for example, for talking out loud about what recent intelligence suggests about the Iranian regime's
right
proximity to being able to deliver a nuclear weapon. And I think that was because the president views that information as part of what the White House is going to have to communicate if they come down on one side or the other on this issue. They're going to have to communicate, well, either they're not that close or they're really close.
All right.
And by the way, you know, Woody Allen made this point decades ago. You can look at a piece of data and the same data, someone could characterize it one way or another. You know, when Woody Allen said, you know, my wife and I make love three times a week, it's hardly ever. And she says, it's all the time. Right. But it's still three times a week. And I think the administration is going to have to come to terms with if the Iranians are to pick a number, and I don't know what the number is, but to pick a number, let's say they're 3 months away from being able to develop a nuclear weapon. The White House is going to have to be prepared to say, and that's just around the corner. That's hardly anything. You know, that's not something we can tolerate. Or they're going to have to say, oh, you know, relax. You know, we got this. They're still 90 days away. We can control the situation.
Right.
And so you already see the administration requiring everyone to shut the heck up until the president makes his decision. And then everyone's commentary is going to have to feed in a supportive manner what that decision is.
Yeah, and I think at this point they're a little bit the victim of their own PR, right? Because on the one hand, a large portion of why he got elected was, whether you think they're conspiracy theories or not, was this promise of openness, right? You had the promise of RFK opening up the health situation and showing people how the sausage is made. You had Cash Patel. Hey, I'm gonna reveal everything. Me and Bongino are gonna reveal everything. Tulsi Gabbard. Oh, we're gonna tell you exactly what's going on. And then all of a sudden, you've got this bombing, and nobody knows what to say. And it was interesting that you had Tucker Carlson interviewing Senator Cruz, and a fascinating confrontational interview, if you saw it. It was like off the rails, not something you would expect typically in this moment in time. And Cruz seemingly let out of the bag that, hey, we were in on this bombing. We're attacking Israel. And when Carlson jumped in and said, wait a second, I thought you said we had no knowledge of this. We're not supporting this. He said, well, by we, I meant Israel's attacking, but we know about it and we support them, but we're not bombing Iran. It was a very awkward 2 minutes, Mike.
It was extremely awkward, and it did suggest what it is that drives us as libertarians crazy, which is elected officials in the United States consider Israeli foreign policy and American foreign policy to be virtually the same thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is what I was talking about a few minutes ago. We need to view these as two very, very different debates. You know, what Israel does is one debate.
Right.
And on some level, one might even go so far as to argue none of our business. Right? Or we wish it were none of our business. Unfortunately, it's a lot of our money, arms, and prestige right. at stake, not only because they're an ally, but because they're a client, because we have given them so much in terms of resources. You know, it's one thing to have cultural connectivity. It's another thing to have someone else's foreign policy to be your client.
Right.
And it's a very, very awkward moment when an elected official of the United States suggests not only that that's true, but that that's okay.
Right.
And for us, I think we wish that that was two very different debates. And you know, a lot of us have strong feelings about Israel. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time
with
Israelis, but you know, I've spent some time there. I've sent my kids there. I've sent, you know, my kids to train in the area and traveled the West Bank as well as Israel north to south. I grew up in a family of faith with strong feelings about the Holy Land. There are any number of reasons why Americans feel close to Israel as a nation, as a society, as a people, and as a government. But that doesn't have to imply that Israel doesn't deserve its own foreign policy.
Right.
Israel is the big military power in the area, mostly because it's the big economy in the area. It can afford to be the big military power in the area. It believes, and I think probably correctly, believes that it has reason to be defensive, to require itself to have a strong military presence. It has plenty of neighbors who have historically not wanted to recognize Israel's right to exist.
Right.
So I think it would be very hard to argue that Israel should not have a strong military presence and power. And for this reason, I think that you can make a strong argument that it's time for the United States not to be just handing over money and resources and linking our foreign policies when Israel can take matters and protect its own interests, can take matters into its own hands. So however you feel about Israel, you know, I personally have always my life being a pro-Israel type of person. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have their own independent foreign policy. And by the way, you can be pro-Israel. You can believe that they have a right to exist. You can be the type of person who recognizes they have to have a strong military and still be critical of the way their government has conducted foreign policy over the last couple of years and over the last couple of decades. Indeed, I think we need to recognize that a huge proportion of the Israeli population,
All right.
Maybe not half, depending on how you ask the question. But approaching half, depending on how you ask the question, is not in support of Netanyahu's prosecution of the war in Gaza, his positioning with regard to Israel's long-term ambitions,
right,
including the West Bank and including Gaza, and his inability to peacefully strike deals in the area that would make Israel safe without these recurring wars. There is a lot to be skeptical there because he has made statements that suggest a strong streak of nationalism ahead of a strong streak of protectionism. In other words, he does want Israel to be safe and talks about it all the time. Good for him. He also talks quite a bit about Israeli nationalism and long-term ambitions. Not all, those two concepts not always fitting together well. So you can see why a lot of folks are skeptical and why he's not always that popular at home.
Yeah, and you can see it here as well, right? Like the to me, look, I've always said there are a couple of political issues that are close to unsolvable. Number one on that list is abortion and abortion rights and pro-life, pro-choice. I think to me that's the most unsolvable political issue in this country, without a doubt.
All right.
Possibly right below that might be the Israeli issue because you see a lot of it, and especially in the Republican base, Mike, you see a lot of it that it's also tied in very close to religious beliefs as well, right? So another awkward moment in the Carlson-Cruz interview, and I'm using this as sort of like encapsulating, you know, the political.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting exchange. Keep going.
Yeah, was when Tucker was trying to, and I'm not a Tucker Carlson fan. I'm neutral towards him. But like when he started asking him questions like, do you think it's okay that they're spying on us? Do you support them spying on us? Well, everybody spies on everybody. Yeah, but I'm asking about Israel. You know, and you could see the sort of like the jabbing and the stick and move. And then what I thought was fascinating, that Cruz at one point resorted to biblical scripture. Some people saying he got it completely wrong. I'm not a biblical scholar. I won't comment. But to me, it was fascinating that if you're a sitting U.S. senator, if you're an elected official, when someone asks you to justify your support for a military action, you're quoting the Bible. Now, this is not to impugn anyone's faith, but as a matter of public service in the United States, we're not a theocracy, to justify military action or support of military action based on biblical interpretation,
all right,
to me, to Big John, sounds kind of wacky. And it wasn't the sort of like, with God's help, we'll prevail. It wasn't that sort of thing. It was like, in this passage of the Bible, it says we got to support the nation of Israel. By nation, we mean this. Oh, what does nation mean? And then it got into some, like, dogmatic stuff. So I was like, I didn't understand that. I found that off-putting, to be not because of the religion per se, but the use of religion as a justification for saying we're doing the right thing if we're helping bomb Iran. They're not Christians after all.
It was awkward. There's no getting around the fact that it was awkward.
Yeah.
It was particularly awkward coming from because he's a smart guy. He's an analytic guy. He's a man of the law. That's always been his pet.
Right.
He was the constitutionalist who understood not only how the law works, but how the law should work. And so if I were his advisor, which I'm not, I would say, Senator, you're undermining your brand. Part of the reason why we have listened to you over the years is because you're a old calculating attorney who stands up with the Constitution. What are you doing? Right? You might expect it more likely to hear from Mike Tremont, who admits he was raised a Calvinist and once in a while says, you know, I come from a pretty biased background on this.
Right.
And it influences your thinking. You can't help it. Ted Cruz, I think it caught us a little off guard. Look, the way that I sort of view that piece of their discussion is in a larger context of, as I had mentioned earlier, there's a lot of cultural connectivity.
Yes.
And part of that is biblical. And a lot of it isn't, right? We have a lot of dual citizens who go back and forth, Israeli-American dual citizens, and what I might characterize as dual cultural citizens, right? We have a lot of Jewish Americans who feel very strongly about Israel, a lot of Christian Americans who feel very strongly about Israel, and a lot of Israelis who feel very strongly about the United States for a lot of cultural reasons, not the least of which was the United States and the United Kingdom's support of the formation, creation, support of the launch of the nation of Israel. There are deep, deep reasons that are either explicitly religious or borderline religious, depending on your definition of religion,
right?
For these cultural connections, and there's just no getting around that. There's no getting around that. People have often said, well, why is it that the United States and the United Kingdom have historically had what we call it's almost like a capital S, the special relationship, right?
Right.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of cultural connectivity there that borders on what one might characterize as religious. You know, it's damn near religious that we cooperate with the United Kingdom on so many issues, including foreign policy and how we see the world.
Right.
And it's hard to describe that analytically. You know, Henry Kissinger said we have no permanent allies. And I think there were people in London who said, really?
All right.
I think you do. And I think if Henry were to say that today, talking about today's hit regarding Iran, I think that there would be people in Jerusalem who would say, I think you do. And that's almost a for better or for worse thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it raised so many eyebrows when the president made comments about Canada that upset them, because I think that we view and accept as a matter of faith, as an article of good faith, we accept that Canada will always be our strong ally, and that runs to not just the geographic proximity, but the cultural connectivity. So, having said all of that, yeah, I agree with you. It was extremely awkward, but in the grand scheme of things,
yeah, it's not that so much as I don't know. Maybe it's because of my particular personality. I was like, if I ask you, hey Mike, why did you go slug that guy in the face just now? Right?
Right.
If you turned around and told me the Holy Spirit moved me to do so, I take you at your word that you were moved by the Holy Spirit, but no one is going to be convinced that you were justified in hitting that guy in the face just by saying the Holy Spirit.
Right, I might convince you that was enough. I might even convince the guy that it was enough, but convincing the cop who shows up is a different matter, right?
Right, and that's...
The cop might believe me and still say, good for you, put your hands behind your back.
Right, because as a matter of law in this country...
And that is a different, that is a good example. And there are examples where, let's not go down this rabbit hole too far, but there are examples when sometimes you just got to punch a guy in the face and be willing to go to jail for it, right?
Right.
That's another ethical issue, which is not completely unrelated.
Right, but historically we've seen this happen. Like one of my favorite things being Greek is from Greek mythology where, the Athenian general who took up behind Leonidas went against Athenian law. And he said, no, this is so bad. I don't care if I get hung afterwards. I'm going to sail out to sea and I'm going to block up the sea passage for Thermopylae, right? He went against law. If you read about it, he actually embezzled money to build up the navy against his government's wishes, right?
Right.
So my
and
point there
are those who would argue that that was not a good idea. And I think that we are facing something that is not completely – I didn't know this conversation was going to go there, John.
Neither
not
did I.
Not completely without analogy.
Yeah.
The president, the administration, does not have congressionally granted authority, and I think most scholars would argue does not have constitutional authority to go to war with Iran without either Congress behind it or an explicit threat from Iran.
Right.
And so this is a matter of, you know, how do you feel about the executive power, right? If your argument is Senator Cruz's, or if your argument is we won a lot of votes in November, not carrying a lot of water for a libertarian, right?
Or for a lot of the American public, Mike. I think
a lot of Republicans.
Bingo, because, you know, we keep putting off the actual Iranian question, but I think this is so fascinating. We'll get there eventually. But this is what's so fascinating to me is that within the Republican ranks and by proxy through the social media influencers that support MAGA and really, to a large extent, propelled MAGA, they're starting to see us. You saw where Trump basically insulted Tucker Carlson for the interview he had with Cruz, where he said Tucker Carlson isn't even on the network anymore. Tucker Carlson should you know, learn to, you know, blah, 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 but get behind it. Little Tucker. And it was reminiscent of Musk. So, you know, when Musk said, hey, this bill is bloated, we shouldn't pass it, it all became like Musk is nothing without me, blah, 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 until Musk kind of relented and they made up, kissed and made up a week later. I kind of see it with Carlson, Tucker Carlson now. Tucker Carlson's a nobody. He's not on Fox anymore, blah, blah, blah.
And the president said that Tucker called him and apologized.
Right. Now, whether I, you know, take it at face value, whether he actually did or not, Tucker hasn't said anything. But this is now the second time, third, if you count Ramaswamy, right? If you kind of put Ramaswamy in that bucket, and Mike, not interestingly enough, of three different issues, immigration, economy, and now war.
And this is what I was saying earlier. The president likes it when people rally around his decision, and he doesn't want you to get out ahead of that.
So
I will tell you what our opinion is when I tell you.
Right, and he doesn't like dissension, which I understand the public dissension. I get it. But at the same time now, how do you view how much political capital he has left? Because he burned a lot on the economy with the tariffs and with the, you know, all that. He burned a lot at the very visceral imagery, the militaristic imagery of guys in black masks showing up to Home Depot, rounding up people waiting for work and disappearing them, as well as the actual Americans who have disappeared. And now he's like, hey, trust me, and this is another troubling thing, I've seen stuff you haven't. Trust me when I tell you, we would be right if we bombed, if we sent over those bunker buster bombs to Iran, because they're not allowed to have nuclear weapons. So now he's burned political capital on three distinct political categories, in my opinion, immigration, the economy, and now foreign policy. So talk to me about that.
I understand. You're not wrong about any of that. But I would offer the following phrase.
All right.
Not that much.
Okay, fair
a
enough.
A lot of his base
all right,
is okay with, we got to do whatever we got to do to be poor people.
All right.
I think a lot of his base is,
all
we
right,
got to do whatever we got to do to support America first-oriented trade policy and economy. A lot of his base will be fully trusting his judgment with regard to Iran. Right?
All right.
And with regard to the parade. Even.
So all right.
Part of what Clinton has calling for him is the Democrats reacting that way to these.
All right.
As much. The Democrats really need to call you and me on advice about how to handle this. They need to step up their game in terms of sophistication. Because, you know, there are reasons to criticize any administration, but the Democrats go about it in such a ham-handed fashion that it causes the president's base to rally around him. And he says, I think correctly, you know, I think that right. The president's base is able to say, look, we've got to cut the president some leeway here, because the alternative is worse. And in many cases, they're right. I'm not trying to be critical of that concept. You know, it's hard to say, don't cut President Trump too much slack when you're the person who supported Joe Biden's immigration policy. You get where I'm going.
They're missing their Sam Nunn or Joe Lieberman, to quote a couple of old school Democrats, that could pretty much hover near the middle of the political spectrum, right? Like a Sam Nunn. He was a Democrat, right? Sam Nunn was a Democrat, but he was very much someone who was pro-military, for those that don't remember, Senator Sam Nunn, Southerner. And he was like a Republican light. Like,
Sure. Well, they got their Fetterman, and they're getting ready to run him out on a rail.
And that's the thing. Whereas Fetterman might have presented a reasonable alternative, all the other drapings that come with Senator Fetterman, the look, the physical look, that he can't seem to show up in a suit.
He's also not helping himself. If he would call for some advice, I would probably turn him into a little bit of a libertarian and maybe even a Republican, but he has got to step up his game. He does have some good ideas. You know, his instincts are from time to time correct. And he steps on his own message. So having said all of that,
right.
I do think that this particular issue is potentially more hazardous for the president's political base, because getting into a foreign war would explicitly contradict what a lot of people believe was, in effect, a campaign promise.
Agreed.
To stay out of foreign wars, whereas the president's immigration promise and campaign pledge was he's going to close the border and deport people who shouldn't be here. We're just arguing about, you know, should he have done this while doing that, or should he have done that while doing this? It's not the same thing as running against a campaign pledge, whereas I think some Republicans would interpret an attack on Iran as explicitly a violation of what he had promised us.
Right, right. And he was already sort of, not a lot, to your point, not really burning too much capital on this, but one of his campaign promises, and somebody on X put together a montage of him during the campaign saying, if I'm in office, I end the Russian-Ukraine war in 24 hours. And that was not a one-off. That was like a campaign mantra. We still have the Russian-Ukraine war going on, right? So he's kind of so far failed on that just miserably from his own campaign promises. And now there's the potential of entering a separate war. So to your point, maybe this is the one that he has to burn a little capital on.
Maybe. And we will see how it goes, because I think that in foreign affairs, very difficult to know how things are going to pan out. I think most Americans are traditionally deferential to the president, even in cases where the president is of a different party.
Right.
There were plenty of Democrats who were deferential to the Bushes when they dragged us into conflicts, saying, well, they've got more information than we do. They're looking out for our commercial interests or retribution for 9/11. And there were people who were willing to give the administration a lot of leeway, a lot of slack, and a lot of time. And it's just a matter of seeing how it plays out.
Right.
You know, people forget, you know, okay, Iraq, 20 years later, we killed 1 million people. We spent trillions of dollars. We eroded our standing around the world. We accomplished a grand total of nothing. Well, George W. Bush is long out of office, and we no longer hold him accountable. I think a lot is going to depend on how this goes. If we get into the conflict, and the most likely way that we do that is by bombing the nuclear facility, which is apparently under something like 50 to 80 meters of earth. Think about that. So you can see why it is that the Israelis are having a hard time getting to it. We're the only ones with these 30,000-pound bunker-busting bombs. It would take multiples of them. It would take B-2 bombers. It's complex operation. The assets to pull it off, including refueling aircraft, are being moved into place to give the president the option of doing that. If we were to do that, a limited strike with a particular purpose, if we were to do that in assistance of the Israeli objective and the American objective of precluding the Iranians from achieving a nuclear weapon. And that's where the story were to stop. I think a lot of people would say that wasn't unreasonable. We have always articulated that we didn't want the Iranian regime to have a nuclear weapon. The president is saying it every 20 minutes now. We understand the Israeli position because And again, the Iranians are not helping themselves by failing to recognize Israel's right to exist. They have talked about blowing Israel off the face of the earth. If you, whatever type of government, whatever kind of politician you were in Israel, you could be forgiven for being a war hawk toward Iran, right?
Right.
If you weren't standing with a hard line against Iran, you're just frankly not doing your job. So however you feel about Benjamin Netanyahu, you got to recognize that this is a fight that the Iranians have leaned into, right? They have not done themselves any favors. Okay, if that's where the story stops, I think a lot of people would say that makes sense. I don't think, you know, anyone would give the administration too hard a time. Maybe, you know, the occasional libertarian, but in the main, most Americans would say that that made sense. The problem is, I think it's unlikely that it would stop there.
Yeah, whether it's economic or boots on the ground, I think you're absolutely right. Not that, because some people will regress to, well, why does Israel get to have 80 or 100 nuclear warheads, but insist that all of its neighbors remain at zero? That, so we leave that argument aside. But on the very practical matter of, if you could get in and out and it was like one bombing run, you destroyed it, and then you're out, you're right. The Dave Smiths of the world would still be squawking. That's a separate issue, but, you know. But
yeah.
But I think most of the MAGA base would
be, hang in there with the president.
Would probably hang in there if he articulated that that's all he intended to do.
All right.
And if the Iranian response
all right,
was not to
terror, yeah. Yeah.
So how does this go wrong?
I think
there are a few specific ways that this goes
right.
wrong.
Right.
Potentially. We don't know what's going to happen. But potentially, the Iranians can fight back against American assets in the region. And that includes the air base in Saudi Arabia, right? Prince Hilton. Iran could go after the air base in the UAE. And importantly, the Iranians could go after the ammo fleet naval facility in Bahrain. All these places are much, much closer to Iran than Israel is. And so this is a way, and by the way, even if the United States doesn't get involved, just concerned that just helping Israel along the way would be enough for Iran to go after these facilities. So far, I think Iranians have, they don't want this to expand into a regional conflict. They don't want the United States coming into it. No, they should want to keep that seat out of it. So the particular is this, does the bombing of the Iranian nuclear facility change their calculus? And I think the likely response is yes. It would change profoundly. I don't think we want to be in the business of underestimating the extent to which these nuclear facilities, the ability to enrich uranium, is a part of the long-term fundamental strategy of Iran.
I could sit here and argue, oh, they have every right. I'd be an idiot not to say that Iran or any theocratic nation having a bomb, a nuclear bomb, isn't concerning, right? But at the same time, you know, you got to make the same argument on the Israeli side, which is like, why do they get to be the – and for as much as the U.S. preaches, the only country to ever use nuclear weapons – during wartime, it's us. So you know, the irony, the hypocrisy, is, you know, it's dripping off of the United States right now. And then, Mike, the other thing is, short of military action, the other possibility is that Iran chokes off all the shipping lanes for oil, meaning that
– Or both.
Right, or both. But let's say they don't want to get into fisticuffs. They could just shut down those shipping lanes or slow them – to a crawl.
Right, and that would lead to military conflict as well, because the only way to enforce it would be through firepower. So the Strait of Hormuz is, of course, quite narrow. It is very difficult to defend because the Iranians can attack it from a distance. and they have the ability to attack it up close. I'll pause border Iran at that point and exercise substantial control over it. The United States, of course, tried to keep the shipping lane open. The United States would be obliged to go after the facilities the Iranians use to fire on our ships. And all of that does bring up a third possibility.
All right.
Which is not to say,
all right,
you know, there are only three, but another possibility, and this isn't an or, you know, it could be an and.
All right.
Iranians could go after commercial facilities in the area.
All right.
And they have demonstrated a willingness to do so in the past.
Right.
And this I find potentially the most dangerous, ironically, because if the Iranians were to go after, say, oil refining and production facilities in Saudi Arabia,
right,
which is a relatively easy thing for them to do, Saudi Arabia into it potentially. And I'm not sure, you know, the Saudis say they don't want to get into a conflict. I'm sure that they don't. They're commercially oriented. Good for them.
All right.
I'm not sure it would take a whole lot.
All right. All right.
They resent Iranian influence in the area, in the region. They should resent Iranian influence in the area. They can help participate in paring that back. If the United States were to come into it at the same time, I think the Saudis would be more than happy to play whatever role they felt like they needed to. The Saudi military budget has been absolutely gigantic over the past decade, and for a reason.
Right.
You don't build it up to be that strong without a hanging implication that you might have to use it someday, and with that comes a willingness to do so, because if we understand anything about military politics, it is that capability and willingness seem to go hand in hand. As much as we like to talk about the intimidation factor of being willing to use something and not having to, at the end of the day, it's a rare military that has enormous capability and then doesn't use it.
Right.
So I would fear that the Saudis might come into it for that reason. I fear that the Emiratis could come into it. Bahrain, Qatar, all of these surrounding nations have commercial facilities that the Iranians could attack because they're relatively close. It would hurt the United States. The problem is that it would drag these nations into the potential conflict, and that would drag the United States into it as well.
Right.
I think this is a huge risk for us.
Right.
So, Mike, just to wrap up, because this it was a great discussion so far, but not initially the way we had planned. So let me just get a wrap up from you. First of all, how would you have handled this situation? And then B, short term, say in the next month or so, how do you see this situation evolving?
All right.
It's obviously a hard question, but there are answers. There are some answers, especially thematically. I think that the White House was correct to be pursuing negotiation with the Iranian regime.
All right. All right.
I think that
Those
negotiations were not well served by the Israeli attack.
All
to the extent to which the administration knew about the Israeli attack, in my view, they should have delayed it. They should not have given the green light. They should have given a very, very hard red light. And that's not an easy thing for an American administration to do to an Israeli government. You know, we know that the Eisenhower administration was able to how the Israeli government, but that was a long time ago and a very different government and a very different military capability. But if the Israeli government is going to continue to be a client of the United States, something that I very much wish were not the case, I believe that these two foreign policies need to be separated. If you believe that these two foreign policies need to be joined at the hip, then the White House needs to have told, it's too late now, but should have told the Israeli government, not yet. And at the same time, they should have told the Iranian regime, it's coming, the bombing, we're probably going to do it ourselves. The Israelis might do it with our green light, but one way or another, it's coming. So when we say negotiation, it's with a clock running. And I think that there are those in the administration and there are those in the Israeli administration that do not believe in negotiation. Those voices need to be marginalized and quieted. And that's not to say that you shouldn't have a military option hanging over, like the sword of Damocles, over the head of the Iranians. I understand that. You need to give negotiation a long runway, especially when talking about something that is so central to long-term strategic interests of the Iranians. That doesn't mean you have to honor their long-term strategic interests, but you need to recognize what they are. And for them to give that up is something that's going to take a long time. This is why so many in Israel argue for regime change in Iran. They believe, I think correctly, that without regime change, the Iranians would come back and come back and come back to the development of a nuclear weapon, which, by the way, is one of the reasons to argue against U.S. military interventionism. If the United States gets involved and blows up this particular facility and there's no regime change, what's the next thing that's going to happen? The bulldozers are going to come out, they're going to clean up the facility, and they're going to build another one. And they're going to keep doing it until they have a nuclear weapon. Okay, so how do you prevent that in the long run? I think that you need to eventually we need regime change, but as we all know, handling that in a militaristic fashion just doesn't work as a practical matter, never mind that deeply profound ethical problem you and I have with it. It just doesn't work. And so we're going to have to wait on that, whether it's an explicit change in regime or whether it's a change of heart. It's going to take a long time. Yeah. And one of the problems with a mere change of heart is that you don't believe it right away. You need an administration in Tehran that says, we're going to leave Israel alone. And you need them to say it consistently for a decade. At the end of that period, you might feel differently. But until and unless that happens, I agree with President Trump, you cannot allow that administration, one that says we're going to bomb another nation off the face of the earth, you cannot allow them to have a nuclear weapon. That's all there is to it. It's not our fault. It's their fault. So you need to negotiate your way through this. I did not get the impression the administration was as creative as it could have been in terms of providing enriched materials for an energy-producing framework. This is something with which we could have helped them. We could have advantaged them commercially, economically, in terms of power production.
All right.
I understand a lot of people are skeptical that the Iranians actually have an interest in this, given how much oil they have, right? And I get skeptical, too. But you got to call their bluff. You have to say, okay, if you're really all that interested in power, we'll give you the uranium. It's going to come at a cheap price. It's going to come with a lot of inspectors. We'll even deliver some know-how in terms of developing. That's probably not going to come in and say it's going to, you know, the French are actually better at this than we are. We'll facilitate a team of Frenchmen to come over and help you develop your nuclear power facilities. And we're going to help you make this work. We're going to help make your economy work. And over time, we're going to pare back on the economic sanctions. We're going to help you get rich.
All right.
And we're going to say that out loud. We're going to tell your population that we're going to help you get rich. And say what you will about, you know, Tehran wanting to control the internet and, you know, it's a Shia regime and everyone is aligned with the theocracy. None of that is true.
None of
that compares to people's interest in getting rich. If we tell them that we're going to help them get rich,
all right,
I think the theocracy is going to have a hard time saying, no. Well, people, don't worry about economic development. We got this. We want to enrich our own uranium, and we want to do it in secrecy.
Right. that you're saying give him more of a carrot than a stick. And
Huge carrot. Yeah. Huge carrot with the implication that we're going to take that carrot and we're going to hit you over the head with it if you don't behave.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. And this is an entirely different discussion, different podcast, but just the recent history, say the last 100 years or so of Iranian history, I think may not align with what you're saying, because I don't know if people remember, in the 50s and 60s, Iran was considered one of the most progressive Middle Eastern countries, like very highly educated. If you see pictures from them, you're like, is this Iran? Like women walking around in miniskirts, no hijabs, no nothing, men in suits and, you know, going off to their high paying office jobs. And it really looked like a mini America out there from our perspective.
Until
the Ayatollah and then the Islamic Revolution took hold. And then it's been as if, from our vantage point, society has regressed. They lost their wealth. It became repressive in terms of human rights and civil rights, right?
Yep.
So there might be some Iranians who still remember what it was like to be referred to as a Persian and remember those years, like the same way you still have people here in the U.S. who say, I remember segregation. I remember, don't talk to me about, you know, where we are and where we've been, because I lived it. Granted, those people are fewer and further between. So in Iran, though, I would wonder if the theocratic hold is too strong for that type of carrot. And maybe that's a question for a different episode, but I just wanted to leave you with
that. It is an interesting question. I don't think anyone actually remembers the Shah except for, you know, maybe me. And I didn't have to live under the Shah. I do remember when his son, the prince, came to play soccer at, you know, a school next to mine when I was in college in New York. Those were the days.
Right.
But we have to remember that it wasn't merely everyone getting rich. It was also a lot of people getting rich who were in power.
Right.
And there was a tremendous amount of resentment because, as it turns out, the Shah was corrupt.
Of course. Yeah.
And the CIA is not always good at picking winners who aren't corrupt.
Right. Or ever good at it.
Right. You know, it turns out that if you corruptly put someone into power, they might be as corrupt as you are. And, you know, maybe you should have the hands off the whole stupid thing in the first place. That is another podcast.
Right.
But I think we have the ability to say, you as a regime can stand, believe me, I recognize a whole lot of people have said this about the communist, Chinese Communist Party, and a lot of people have looked naive and silly because it turns out that you cannot motivate those people with money. That is a government that doesn't care about its people getting wealthy. That's the conclusion that you just have to come to.
Right.
But in this particular case, what we're saying is, we're giving you an out, even if you don't give a rat's ass about what we're talking about. We're giving you a graceful way out. And let's remind you that here's the date. You know, you push a piece of paper across the table, and it's not an amount of money.
It's a date.
And you might remember George Herbert Walker Bush announced when we were going to start bombing the Iraqi forces in Kuwait and told them the hour, right? We're giving you the date and the hour and the place and how it's going to go.
All right.
But on his promise.
All
you
right.
You need to be very, very clear. At the same time, give them a graceful way out. Now, if all of that fails, then I believe you need to go to Congress. You need to make your case. You need to get the authority. Make good if you really believe.
All right.
We need to talk about this as well. If you really believe that Iran is about to develop a nuclear weapon, which brings us to last thing that we need to talk about, the analogy to Colin Powell going to the United Nations and describing, oh, yes, we do believe that the Iraqis have weapons of mass destruction. They have chemical weapons, or at least the ability to deliver them in a hurry.
Right.
Sounds familiar. And it turns out that he was largely wrong. I can't say 100% wrong because there's traces, and they, you know, the Iraqi administration did have an interest and did stick their toe in the water. I get it, but there was no immediate threat, as we subsequently learned.
Yeah.
Okay. So where is our Colin Powell today, whom we can trust? Well, as it turned out, Powell lost his reputation over this issue. He was explicitly sent to make the case because everyone trusted him. And it turned out that he was wrong. Huge debate, especially among libertarians, was he wrong on purpose or was he fooled? I guess we'll never know. Those of us who, you know, try to see the glass half full and try to believe there are still people of good faith out there would like to believe that he was fooled and that he made a mistake. Maybe it doesn't matter. Today, we need a way to figure out and make public, you know, that information. I don't think that we have that. We know that. And it's absolutely critical to this debate. To a certain extent, we're having a debate without the relevant facts. And to bring this conversation full circle, this is where we started, with Tulsi Gabbard putting information out there and the administration telling her to shut up because we haven't decided what we want to say about that information yet. It undermines your faith in the process of learning the information, interpreting it, developing it, and making it public.
Yep. Right. Yes. And listen, that's the conundrum. If you run on saying everything will be transparent, you better be prepared to live that, right? Because right now, even for someone who's not a fan of the administration, I sympathize with them because they can't do anything without, you know, mobs of people, experts on Twitter, on X, saying, show me your proof. Show me why this. And why does this contradict that? You know, so, you know, whether it was Tulsi Gabbard's note, whether it was Cruz, in my opinion, screwing up that interview with Tucker Carlson, I think he should have known better. You start adding stuff up, right? And then all of a sudden it kind of looks, hey, they're at it again. You know, whether you have faith in Trump or not, and I don't care if you think he's being manipulated by the deep state or Project 2025 or whatever, the point is people are starting to say this is BS. It's smelling really bad right now because we can't trust that it's really an imminent danger. As someone pointed out, Iran has been 3 weeks away from a nuclear weapon for the last 30 years. For the last 30 years, they've been 3 weeks away from a nuclear weapon, right? So I understand what you're saying, but I also understand the frustration of not just libertarians, just people in general. Like at this point, a lot of Republicans, a lot of MAGA folks are like, this isn't what we signed up for. And at this point, the only true vociferous supporters of the president are either people that directly work for him, which you would expect because they were all vetted based on loyalty for the most part, or his paid influencers, you know, like the Benny Johnsons and whatnot are still out there. Trust him. He's okay. So having said that, let's see how this works out.
This works out. As it turns out, this would be the last comment I have. As it turns out, leading a democracy is hard.
Yep.
And this is why, and it's why as libertarians we say, but as Americans we say it as well, this is why you need to articulate your principles. You need to say them over and over again, and you need to stick by them because when it hits the fan, that's your only foundation. That's what you got to peel back to and stand on and say, yeah, I'm gonna take some flack for this, but you know why, right? You can say you don't like it. You can say that you see the facts on the ground differently. You can say that you have philosophy. You can say that I'm an idiot. You can say that you'd rather listen to other people. You can say that you're either disinterested or that disinterested in other people around the world.
Right.
But you cannot say you don't get it. You cannot say I didn't warn you that I did not articulate my principles. And that's why leading a democracy is hard because you're going to catch all that flack, and this is why you need to articulate those principles in advance. So if the president said, stay out of foreign wars and transparency, and those are two things we're going to lean into, to your point, you damn well better do it.
Right, right.
Well, it's been an exciting sort of conversation here today. I didn't expect it to go in this direction, but I like the direction we ended up taking, Mike. I think it was a good conversation. So for all of you, this show, Liberty Lens, is here every Thursday on Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Find us at Grumblings Media, all one word, all the major platforms. My friend Mike Termont and myself, this is Big John. We'll catch you again next week.